something like 200,000 refugees in all left France. The majority of Protestants stayed in France, but about 200,000 left. Now, the largest single number went to the Netherlands. The next largest, probably 40 or 50,000, came to England. About 10,000 came to Ireland, I believe. Now, in terms of the total population of the countries at the time, it's probably a similar number, and therefore suggests perhaps a similar contribution.
Strangers in Ireland, the Huguenots remembered 300 years on, with contributions from Jean-Paul Pittiong, Michael Goldie, Robin D. Gwynn, Vivian Costello, Patrick Kelly, and John Miller.
It's standard amongst French historians to divide the Huguenots into the southern ones and the northern one. Roughly, the Loire divides a group of Huguenots centered around Paris and then scattered in very small communities north of the Loire, and the very high density of Protestants in some southern regions, particularly in Languedoc, around Montpellier, around Nîmes, and in the southeast in the Dauphiné.
So, I mean, what I'm trying to clarify is whether the Catholic-Protestant divide broke down in straightforward geographical terms, rural-urban.
It didn't. The distribution really reflected the state of the communities after the 40 years of civil war in the 16th century. There were a high concentration in the south, dispersed communities in the north, but generally there was a patchwork of high-density areas as regards Protestantism and very low-density areas. But that geographic division is only the most elementary one. The more important one, I think, is that the religious divide cut across French society. It cut across the groups, the various social groups. There was a divided aristocracy. There was a divided bourgeoisie in the towns. It cut across even the families because of the extended notion of that the family represents in the 16th, 17th century. You could not, I think, find in certain region one family which wouldn't have members on both sides of the divide.
The Edict of Nantes itself was clearly an important stage. What led to that between the early 16th century it's coming to pass? What kind of circumstances led to it?
A situation of general civil and military dissidence in the kingdom. The need to bring in some truce between conflicting parties. At the last stage, just say the 5 years before the Edict of Nantes, there were armies commanded by Henry IV, Henri de Navarre was to become Henry IV on one hand. There were armies commanded by the king, and there were also dissident groups of ultra-Catholics who had seized power in Paris. They're known as the League. And for the 30 years which followed, the 20 years which followed the formation of the French Calvinist churches, the country was in more or less a permanent state of civil and religious war. And the need to bring in a truce to settle the situation, once Henry IV had acceded to the throne, having converted to Catholicism, was made imperative also by the situation on the borders. France was in a situation of permanent conflict with Spain as well. So to settle the internal situation, to attempt to contain the religious struggle, Henry negotiated with the representatives of the Huguenots and reached that agreement, which is known as l'Edit de Nantes.
It looked on the face of it as if they were getting a reasonable deal. What price did the Huguenots have to pay?
Yes, they got a good deal in this respect, that the Edict of Nantes, it's the major edict, that of the 13th of April, gave them a legal identity in the general structure, corporate structure, of the state at the time. In other words, although it was not said by name, they were instituted as an estate, an ordre, like the clergy, the first estate, or the aristocracy, the second estate. They had rights to representation at court. They had a right to hold ceremonies which signified, manifested their corporate identity. They, of course, obtained the right of worship in those places where it could be established that there had been some Protestant form of worship before the edict. But at the same time as that, the edict did not grant them specifically the permission to maintain a standing army, although in subsequent brevets, really concessions made privately by the king, a sort of contract between the king and the Huguenots, they were allowed to maintain garrisons in some towns and to have some kind of protection as regards access to office, for instance.
And what about the freedom of power to evangelize?
That was very much curtailed. It was curtailed by one of the articles of the edict, which prevented the spread of any literature or of the giving of any sermon which could be considered seditious or likely to arouse the population. And that curtailed certainly the scope for further proselytizing. In fact, what happens with the Edict of Nantes is that the Huguenot population is frozen legally and religiously into the status that it had at that time. And from then on, a number of its advantages, privileges, or liberties are eroded. The permanence of religious conflict in different forms throughout the 17th century led to a state of constant unrest, a lot of administrative and judicial difficulties, and the rising absolutist state saw the Protestant question, above all, I think, as a question of law and order. This sort of legalized dissidence was unacceptable in the absolutist, statist perspective of the time.
And I want to get a kind of general map of the dispersal, taking it in the two key stages, first of all in the early 16th century and then later after the revocation. Did most of them go away, first of all? What percentage stayed?
No. It's very difficult, of course, to reach accurate figures. But if you consider that there may have been perhaps 1 million French Protestants in the 1680s, that's 1 out of 20 million for the entire kingdom, then it's most likely that not more than 200,000 left the kingdom. And that emigration was not evenly distributed.
The English and still more the Irish immigration are, they're not peripheral, perhaps is the wrong word to use, but they are not the largest foci of Huguenot immigration. The largest concentration of refugees at this stage go to the Dutch Republic, which is perhaps not surprising, as this is the great commercial crossroads of Europe, which has already very, very many links with merchants and businessmen in France. There is also very extensive emigration elsewhere. Other countries, in fact, other states, did much more to attract Huguenot immigrants than England did in 1685-6. As we've seen, James II's welcome was tepid, to put it mildly. Whereas some of the German states, in particular, made great efforts, and sometimes rather fraudulent efforts, to attract French immigrants. They were short of manpower, they were short of skilled men. They were even prepared to try and attract French peasant farmers. So you get extraordinary claimed by one town right up in the north of Germany, up in Prussia, that the climate and the soil are wonderful for vine growing. If the poor French peasants actually tried to grow any vines up in this place, they would have been for a terrible shock. So there are almost a sort of employment agencies for useful Huguenots set up in Switzerland, and particularly at Frankfurt am Main, which were sort of staging posts. They actually called it a turntable, through which Huguenots were dispatched in all directions, basically either up the Rhine towards the Netherlands or sort of northwards and eastwards into Germany.
In the light of your reading, what's your impression of the psychological profile, if you like, of the Huguenot?
They are a mixed bag, as one would expect. It seems that very often it is not, in fact, the very rich, the really successful merchants who leave France. They will probably conform to the Catholic Church, swallowing their principles. And perhaps if they send, they may send other members of the family away, but they will probably stay on to mind the business, which in fact, in a sense, extends their business contacts. The same is true to a large extent of the bankers. One of the ironies of the wars against Louis XIV is that the Louis XIV is actually funded to some extent by loans from Huguenot bankers, which is one of history's many ironies. Perhaps shows that business is much more important than religion, I don't know. For the rest, they are a mixture. There are some who are... Those who tend to go are those whose skills are mobile. Soldiers, sailors, artisans, often highly skilled artisans whose services are very much in demand elsewhere. To some extent, merchants and businessmen, not all that often farmers, partly because the skills which you need, say, to grow vines in the south of France are not skills that you can easily adapt to North Germany or to Ireland or England, for that matter. There's a high proportion of men on their own, although these are sometimes, I think, looking to establish themselves before sending for their wives and families. Occasionally you get, at least going through Frankfurt am Main, you've got not so much whole families as whole villages. Or the Protestant part of the village would just up and go. There was another case of a village in western France where the Protestant part of the community just got up and went and walked through Spain to Cadiz, a whole lot of them, right around the coast. But this is the exception rather than the rule. They tend to be individuals and with a very high proportion of males as against females.
Roughly, there were three main pathways to emigration, to exile. Through the northern borders into Holland, the direct route mostly for the Huguenots north of the Loire and the Huguenots in Paris, across the eastern borders to Switzerland, that would be for the southern and eastern ones, and then through the ports towards England for those living in the western regions. And I have to say that those that left and reached Switzerland only stayed there very often for a short time, that Switzerland acted as a sort of dispatching center, and that the refugees were then sent across to, say, Brandenburg or to Holland, or some indeed even to England and Ireland. There is evidence, in fact, that a number of Huguenot soldiers were recruited in Switzerland for the armies of William and eventually settled in Port Arlington.
In the 16th century, after the Reformation, there were civil wars in both France and the Netherlands, and a good many Protestants came as refugees to England from those wars, but very few to Ireland. So that the first organised communities in England come in 1549-1550, but there isn't an organised community in Ireland until the Duke of Ormond is viceroy in the 1660s. So there's a gap of 110 years.
Apart from that, what are the main differences in the the way that the Huguenots were received in the two countries?
I think there are obvious differences in the climate in England as opposed to Ireland. England was a very Protestant country in the 17th century. By and large, the Huguenots were welcomed. And in the 1680s, England's subjects, who were largely Protestant, felt a bit threatened by the Dragonard in France, where troops were being used to compel Protestants to change their faith. And some of them feared that there might even be Dragonard in England under the Catholic James II. Now, the situation in Ireland has to be different because the majority of the population was Catholic, and therefore, from a Huguenot point of view, a less desirable place to come.
But weren't there many reasons why they mightn't want to come to Ireland apart from that?
Well, they were taking refuge from religious persecution, so they wanted to worship in the way they were used to in France. It was easier for them to do that in England than it was in Ireland, because even once there was a French community in Dublin in the 1660s, it didn't worship in the same way that they had worshipped in France, whereas in England there were French churches worshipping in that way. So that is a further disincentive. Then there's the question of economics. I mean, they were refugees. Many of them had very little. They had to make a livelihood. Ireland's economic prospects were not particularly good in the 1660s. I think they'd improved a lot by the 1690s, and that is when the really large number of Huguenot refugees arrives in Ireland.
But what about Ormond's attempts to attract them, to make the country more attractive to them?
He did want to attract them, and he wasn't the first. The Cromwellian regime had wanted to attract foreign Protestants. The Earl of Strafford in the 1630s had brought over people from France who he thought could act as weavers in Ireland. But these efforts, by and large, hadn't been very successful. Ormond himself had been in France as a refugee in the 1650s, and he had contacts with French Protestantism. And his hopes in the 1660s were certainly on a grander scale than the earlier ones. And he clearly did bring people over and settle them, certainly in Dublin, and it looks as though he encouraged settlement in some other places. For instance, in Chapel Izzard, he set up weavers. But by and large, his efforts didn't work particularly well. And if there hadn't been more persecution in France in the 1680s, they probably wouldn't have survived.
Perhaps you'd tell us something about his 1662 Act and its implications.
Well, the 1662 Act invites foreign Protestants into Ireland and offers them certain advantages which they couldn't have had in England. Most particularly, if they took the relevant oaths, the oaths of allegiance and obedience, then they could automatically become naturalized. Now, that wasn't the case in England, where it wasn't until, in fact, 1709 that there is an act of general naturalization. So that's an important plus for Ireland, because naturalization carried with it certain benefits in regard to trade and taxation, which were and the transmission of land to your successors and heirs, and those were important advantages. But as against that, Ormond was working against all these other hostile factors which made life difficult for him. And in addition, he had to try and overcome the reputation Ireland had all over Europe, really, in the 1640s and 50s, certainly all over Protestant Europe, because it was well known that there had been massacres of Protestants in Ireland in 1641, and the reports of those massacres had been greatly exaggerated. But the Huguenots no doubt believed them.
Avenge, O Lord, thy slaughtered saints whose bones lie scattered on the Alpine mountains cold, even them who kept thy truth so pure of old when all our fathers worshipped stocks and stones. Forget not, in thy book record their groans who were thy sheep and in their ancient folds, slain by the bloody Piemontese that rolled mother with infant down the rocks. Their moans, the veils redoubled to the hills, and they to heaven. Their martyred blood and ashes sow o'er all the Italian fields, where still doth sway the triple tyrant, that from these may grow a hundredfold, who, having learnt thy way, early may fly the Babylonian woe.
When we're thinking about the Huguenots, we're inclined to think that the only problem of persecution in Europe is that going on in France with the Revocation and Catholic persecution. And in England, of course, by the 18th and the 19th century, there's a tremendous sense that England means Protestantism and freedom, and France means persecution and Catholicism. But the point I really wanted to make was that although that becomes true after the Glorious Revolution, when you do get toleration established in England, but before that, that's to say, in the generation after the Civil War, in the reign of Charles II, there's an enormous drive to put down the Puritans. And this is the period when, after Cromwell's rule, the Puritans have been driven out, Charles II has come back to his throne. And there's a tremendous attempt by Cavalier gentlemen, by the bishops of the restored Anglican Church, to get their own back. Very often it was a straightforward case of revenge. But of course it was also a strong commitment to Anglicanism, to the Church of England as the true Reformed Church. And so the Puritans are really out in the wilderness, the Quakers, the Baptists. I suppose the famous example is John Bunyan, who spends 12 years in Bedford Jail. And so all these Puritans are campaigning for toleration in England. And when complaints begin in England, the English start saying, well, poor old Huguenots in France, the Puritans turn around on them and say, well, look, you know, you're as bad. You're persecuting in England. You've got to look to your own problems first. Give us toleration. And they even say, not only do they use the example of the Edict of Nantes and say, look, at least they had some freedom, these Huguenots in France, we want freedom here. But they even start calling the Anglican bishops popish, because they associate persecution with popery. And so they say, until Protestants can be truly tolerant, they can't really call themselves Protestants.
What, in your view, is the key to the transformation that did occur that allowed the kind of tolerance that made the reception of Huguenots something that was worthwhile and attractive for them?
Well, of course, the crucial change is the revolution of 1689, when William of Orange came over, and you get an act of toleration passed into law in 1689, and the whole situation changes then. I think what is important is that when James II is on the throne, he's a Catholic, and there's a strong sense that Protestants should hang together rather than hang separately.
But yes, but what underpins the legislation, in your view? I mean, what kind of shift occurred? I mean, it is astonishing when you think about it that you have this kind of transformation within a comparatively short space of time.
Yes, there is an enormous change, as you say, but, through just a few years. I think what you have to look at in the governors in England, the English ruling orders, is what are they most frightened of? Sometimes they're frightened of two things. They're frightened of Puritans, the old Cromwellians. They don't want that Republican anarchy again. But they're also frightened of popery and Catholicism. And the question is, what weighs strongest in their mind? In the early 1680s, they're desperately frightened of a new Republican uprising by the Baptists and the Quakers and so on. But once James comes to the throne, their fears all change about, and they're really frightened that James is going to impose Catholicism. So now they start hanging together with all the Protestants. So it is a question of their changing fears.
In Ireland, the situation was very particular. In England, there were problems as regards conformity, conforming to the Anglican ritual and accepting Anglican ordination. In Ireland, the settlement here was encouraged specifically by the state, and therefore by the act which really governed this settlement, the 1692 Act, freedom of worship was granted to the emigres, the Huguenots, so that they were entitled to practice their own form of worship and were not required to accept for their pastors religious ordination. Doesn't mean, of course, that some actually did not join the Anglican Church, but they had this freedom of worship, which was not so easy to obtain in the context, say, of late 17th century England.
Before the 1690s, Dublin is the centre where a French community has been established. Then in the 1690s, a whole group develop. The person who's responsible is Lord Galway, who was a French nobleman who had fought for William in various battles in Ireland, of which Orrim was probably the most important, because he made a major contribution. And he wanted his fellow countrymen, and King William also wanted to encourage the Huguenots to come. From his point of view, they were loyal subjects, they had nowhere else to go, they depended on him, they were needy, and they were going to give him good service, so he encouraged them.
There has been a long tradition which has seen Galway as the enemy of Catholicism in Ireland and the chief architect of the increased penal laws of the 1690s, who was attempting to obtain revenge for the sufferings of the Huguenots in France under Louis XIV, and making use of the same sort of techniques that Louis turned against the Huguenots to persecute the Irish Catholics.
And when you began to look at the evidence, what did you discover?
When I turned to the evidence, the picture was quite different and in some ways much more fascinating. It showed that Galway had been consistently misrepresented and that he was certainly not an active persecutor. His involvement with the enactment of the Penal Law of 1697, the famous Bishop's Banishment Act, was that of an administrator and not of a persecutor for conscience' sake. First and foremost, Galway was a soldier. He was, I think, a fairly straightforward individual, taciturn, a man with strong family loyalties, and a man who took seriously his legacy as representative of the Huguenots at the court of Louis XIV, into the very changed circumstances of exile, who saw himself as a leader in exile with a responsibility for helping and protecting the less fortunate members of the refuge. The myth that grew up about him was a deliberately fabricated myth. It's a rather complicated story. First, the myth was generated by agents of the Irish Catholic landed classes who wished to block the legislation banishing the bishops and regular clergy from the country. And it was also exploited by the French because of two reasons. One, that Galway had abandoned estates in France, which under the terms of the Treaty of Ryswick of the summer of 1697, he should in theory have been entitled to receive back now the war was over. The black propaganda was intended to make Galway appear as a rabid persecutor of Catholics so that Louis XIV's Catholic allies, and we must remember that Catholic Europe, the emperor and the Spaniards, supported Louis XIV against the French and the Catholic Irish, that these people would not be prepared to speak in Galway's favour, either to William or, more importantly, to Louis XIV and his ministers. Second reason enters into the world of fantasy and has dimensions of a 17th century James Bond. Galway, before he came to Ireland to take up the governorship in 1697, had been William of Orange's ambassador in Savoy. And in this position, he came to know of facts about Louis XIV's intentions to assassinate William of Orange, which the French king was very anxious to prevent becoming public. The French king consistently denied that he had any involvement with the attempts to assassinate William of Orange. But what Galway found out was that in 1696, Louis had entered into negotiations with a notorious Italian hitman called Count Bozzelli of Bergamo, who arranged to come to London in the entourage of the Venetian ambassador with 50 desperados who were then to attack William in the streets of London and to dispose of him. Galway was then approached by other Italians who offered in turn to dispose of Bozzelli in return for a large payment, and Galway, acting on William's instructions, refused this offer. And naturally, Louis would have found it very embarrassing indeed if any revelations of this kind had been made public. By blackening Galway's reputation, Louis effectively ensured that any revelations that he might make would not be treated with any seriousness by the rulers of Catholic Europe.
Something like 200,000 refugees in all left France. The majority of Protestants stayed in France, but about 200,000 left. Now, the largest single number went to the Netherlands. The next largest, probably 40 or 50,000, came to England. About 10,000 came to Ireland, I believe. Now, in terms of the total population of the countries at the time, it's probably a similar number, and therefore suggests perhaps a similar contribution.
I'm thinking of, in your book, there's a reference to, you look at the sort of genetic, look at this under a kind of genetic heading, and I think you quote, is it Darlington? And I'm wondering if you can look at the Huguenots in terms of their psychology, their makeup as a people. What kind of thoughts have you on that?
I think what strikes me at working on them is the fact that they were refugees. And because they were refugees, they are displaced. They have no option but to work exceptionally hard in order to survive. In order to get away from France, they hadn't just walked out, taking with them whatever they happened to have. They'd faced penalties which ranged from imprisonment through execution, transportation to the New World, to the ultimate penalty, which was service chained aboard the French king's galleys in the Mediterranean, in order to get out. And therefore, to run that sort of gamut and to face the king's ships in France, gassing the holds of ships in case there were Huguenots in barrels trying to get out, to run those sorts of risks, you weren't just walking out with all your possessions. So many of them had very little. And if you're in that situation, firstly, you must have been very determined. And that's going to make an impression on the places you go to. And secondly, you've no option but to work extra hard. You just can't survive if you don't. Fortunately for the Huguenots, the majority of them were people who worked with the skills were in their hands. Weavers, for instance. They carried their skills with them. They could move them. I mean, if they had mostly been, let us say, wine producers, what would they have done in Ireland?
The records in Ireland generally are very bad, so it's quite difficult to find particular family. You can be looking for a long time. But I suppose the first thing I would have done is gone to Lombard Street to look up the earliest possible births and marriage certs. And that will give you parishes and so on. And then you try to look up the relevant parish registers. Then you could go to the public record office. And when you're dealing with Protestant families, there are books of indexes of marriages and births and so on, and some wills. But quite often, the most helpful thing for a Dublin family would be the registry of deeds. If your ancestors ever had any property dealings whatsoever and they're in the registry of deeds, you can find an awful lot of family details in deeds, and it was mostly through that that I eventually found them.
What were the first things you began to discover about your own family, your own family name?
Well, they had changed their name from Leclerc to Clark, which made it very hard to find them because there's lots of Clarks in Ireland. And just like many other Huguenot families who also anglicised their name over the years. But the first Leclerc I could find was a Pierre Leclerc who was definitely in Dublin in 1710. And of course there were Dublin parish registers for the Huguenots specifically, so you can get quite a lot of information for the early period from those. And this man married in Dublin in 1716, another Huguenot, and he set up as a wine merchant, which was a very wise move, because all the people who were tradesmen that were involved in things like weaving and so on found it very hard to make ends meet, whereas a wine merchant had no difficulty keeping going in Dublin because the gentry drank phenomenal amounts of wine. And if you look at the importation of wine, it is an amazing amount per head of population in Ireland at the time. So this Pierre Leclerc became quite prosperous and was able to raise his family in reasonable comfort. And his son, who I was also descended from, died young. But then his son again, Pierre Abercrombie Leclerc, would seem to have been quite a colourful character. He certainly had a lot of property dealings, both in Dublin, Wicklow, Wexford, Tullamore and so on. And he managed to acquire four wives. And he was a linen merchant, by all accounts.
What do you find among your own people of your own family name? What kind of interest in their Huguenot past do you find?
Well, I suppose they would have a certain amount. I think if one has a slightly unusual background, was always vaguely interested. But I certainly wouldn't myself have done anything about actually researching them either if I hadn't felt I needed a hobby at the time. And I found my own family fairly boring, but the Huguenots as a group became fascinating. And in fact, the whole of Dublin in the 18th century was an amazing place, with the gentry entertaining on a lavish scale. On the other hand, dreadful poverty amongst the poorer people. And in fact, many travellers to Dublin at the time state that they never in any other city saw quite such a difference between the poorer classes and the gentry.
Well, two things. I suppose the most important was the unpopularity of the Huguenots. This came out very clearly in a letter from William of Orange to Lord Galway in November 1698. I was surprised that the Huguenots were so unpopular with the Protestant colonists in Ireland, and also the way in which Irish Catholics saw the Huguenots, a mixture of fear and trepidation because they thought the policy of the English government was to replace them in Ireland by Huguenot refugee settlers, and also from the point of view of the Irish Catholics, the soldiers who had gone to France with Sarsfield, jealousy that the Huguenots were being so well treated by the English Protestants, while the treatment they received from the France of Louis XIV was distinctly shabby.
There are differences between Ireland and the rest. Those differences are largely, the rest of Europe, I mean, those differences are largely, I think, governed by the fact that there was no tradition of Huguenot emigration to this country before they came, before the main wave of emigration here. In Holland, there were already long-established Huguenot churches. The same thing was true for England.
From the beginning of the 16th century.
From the very beginning of the 16th century, yes. Whilst here they came into a totally new territory, they tended to concentrate either in the settlement of Port Arlington or in Dublin and Cork. They were few in numbers. It was probably more difficult for them to maintain their identity And I don't mean by this just simply their religious identity, but also their French identity. The two are connected. They attempted to do this through a number of devices, I suppose, such as, for instance, intermarriage. I mean, it's quite clear that for the first two generations, the Huguenot refugees intermarry. Very quickly, they become assimilated in, I suppose, what can be called the ascendancy here.
What attitude, or how sympathetic were they to Irish Catholics who, after 1690, were being persecuted? How did they view that?
Well, that's a very difficult question. I don't think there is any direct evidence that they had that one individual or as a group they expressed their views on the situation. It has to be said that they were, of course, men of the 17th century. They took it for granted that the state should impose religious conformity. They suffered from that, but this was part of their outlook nevertheless. They had, most of those who came here were soldiers, professional soldiers, aristocrats whose only trade was soldiering. A situation of war or of general unrest was not something they were unfamiliar with. I think largely, probably, they ignored the situation of the Irish Catholics. They probably were more sensitive to the situation of the dissenters here, who were in a less favorable position because they were not formally granted freedom of worship than they, the Huguenots, were. However, as they settle, and it took them a certain time to settle, largely because of their profession, they went back to wars. As they settled, I think one can detect a certain awareness of the penal law system which was applied in Ireland, and the parallel could not have failed to strike them. And in this respect, there's a very curious text written by one of the leaders of the dissidents of the guerrilla warfare, which took place in the first decade of the 17th century. As you know, in the Cevennes, there was a rebellion of the Protestants who fought off the king's armies, Louis XIV's armies, for a very long time. Now, the leader, after a truce was made, came over first to England and to Ireland, indeed to Port Arlington. And he published his memoirs. It's the memoirs of the Wars of the Cevennes. His name was Jean Cavalier. And there's a remarkable preface written by him where he makes an argument for general toleration by the state of all religions. And although the Catholics are not designated by name, it is quite clear that he actually intends his text to be read as including them.
In Strangers in Ireland, you heard the voices of Jean-Paul Pittiong, Trinity College Dublin, Robin D. Gwynn, Massey University, New Zealand, Michael Goldie, Churchill College, Cambridge, John Miller, University of London, Patrick Kelly, Trinity College Dublin, and Vivian Costello of Howth County, Dublin, who descends from the Huguenot family of Leclerc.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.